Welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff, and today we're going to be talking with two very interesting people, Fran, who has voluntarily helped a friend of hers as the patient advocate through a recent health crisis, and Frank, otherwise known as Fantastic Frank. Hi, Frank. How are you?
Fantastic.
We could summarize the title for today's show as Be Prepared and Believe in Yourself. Being prepared in the medical world involves today having a healthcare proxy. And a healthcare proxy just means that you name someone else who, if you are not able to speak for yourself, can speak for you in medical matters. This is particularly important now because of the new HIPAA legislation. Under the HIPAA legislation, the Privacy Act, you know that your doctors are constantly telling you what they're going to do with your medical information and so forth, but it also governs who they dare speak to about your medical history. And even people close to you in many other respects need your explicit permission to participate in your medical care. So, for example, your parents automatically have a healthcare proxy while you're a minor child, but the minute you turn 21, your parents also need your explicit permission to talk with your doctor in detail about your medical problems. And this certainly refers to anyone other than your spouse, other than your legal spouse. So if there's someone close to you who's not your legal spouse, then you need to have a piece of paper authorizing them to speak for you in medical matters. The best time to put this together is before you need it. We're going to talk today with Fran, who agreed 15 years ago to be a healthcare proxy for her friend Lisa and was recently called upon to be that healthcare proxy. And later on in the program, we'll meet Fantastic Frank, who will introduce his new comic book and his mission to empower you. This program is brought to you as a public service by the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance. Read about us on our website at powerfulpatient.org. We will be glad to answer as many of your questions as possible. If we use your question on the air, we will send you a copy of our theme CD, Wayfaring Stranger, by Clinton Winford. Again, the website is powerfulpatient.org. Our conversation with Fran came out of a question that we received from a listener on whether or not she needed to have a healthcare proxy in place. A healthcare proxy is always a good idea, whether or not you have a given medical condition right now. There's always a chance that you might have an accident or an illness. It sort of goes with the human condition. So having one of these in place is just like having any other insurance policy. It's cheap insurance. You can pick up the form at any hospital. They'll have the healthcare proxy paperwork that you would need. And then you think who in your life you would trust to speak for you if you were unconscious or unable to speak for yourself. Who would you want to be involved in hearing what the doctor has to say and working with your doctor to keep you comfortable? It's particularly important if your significant other is not your legal spouse. If you want that significant other to be able to speak to your doctor and learn the medical details of what's going on with you and participate in that conversation, then you need to have a healthcare proxy in place. Otherwise, that person has absolutely no legal standing in the hospital. This is really something that you do need to take care of before a particular situation arises. So just take the time to do it, and then you won't have to worry about it. Here's a good example of why you need one. Fran, I thought maybe we could talk about your experience with Lisa. So you said several years ago she asked you if you would be her healthcare proxy?
Right. She was a young woman at the time. She was about, maybe 35, 40 years old. And she came over one time and asked if I would be her healthcare proxy. And I thought that was the funniest thing in the world because she was young and she wouldn't need anything like that. And why should she go ahead and do it now? Mm-hmm. But anyhow, I agreed to do it. I felt actually flattered that she asked me. And I didn't think anything of it. I figured I'll never have to do anything for her.
Yeah, and this was 5 or more years ago?
Right.
Yeah.
She's 48 now, and I did have to do something for her, and I became her healthcare proxy. And that really had a lot of responsibilities to it, which I never thought about before.
So she didn't have any relatives in town or something like that, or nobody that she trusted to...
She had, her parents were back in Michigan and they were deceased, mm-hmm. and there was nobody, no family member here. And I've known Lisa for years and years and years, and we're very close. And so she asked me as a friend to do this for her.
So a healthcare proxy is if you are in a medical situation where you can't speak for yourself, that someone else can come and advocate for you on your behalf.
Yes.
So and, if you're in an automobile accident or have some other disabling medical condition, temporary or longer term.
Right. So with Lisa, she was found by the superintendent of her condo, and they had called the police. She was found unresponsive and took her by ambulance to the hospital. And she was in ICU for 9 days, 10 days.
My goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
And this turned out to be a diabetic incident?
It was a diabetic coma. She had been a little bit ill, feeling under the weather over the weekend. And that Monday morning, she was supposed to be in Delaware for business. Mm-hmm. And her contact person, her colleague and friend, who was already in Delaware, was waiting for her to show up for the meeting. And when she didn't show up, Lisa is very, very responsible. Her colleague called home, and there was no answer, and then called a mutual friend who lived in the building, who called the supervisor, the superintendent. Mm-hmm. And so Lisa had made her last phone call at 3:30 in the morning to the limo people not to pick her up to get to the airport. She had to be there by 5:30 in the morning. So... she canceled that, and that was the last that anybody had heard from her. And the police and superintendent found her at 4 in the afternoon the next day. So she needed someone to speak for her, really.
So how did someone know to get in touch with you?
Because this other person knew that I was her healthcare proxy.
The mutual friend.
Uh-huh. Right.
Okay, so they called you, and then what did you do at that point?
Then I went down to the hospital and tried to see if I could be helpful. And a lot of people had tried to call the hospital, and the hospital really did not approve of that. Being in the ICU, they wanted all the attention on Lisa, the mm-hmm, patient, mm-hmm. and not on all her friends.
Right.
And she has a wide circle of friends. So... I was the main contact for her stay in the hospital, and any news of her updated medical care would go through me, and the doctors and so on made me the point of contact for all of this.
Right, and these days with all the healthcare privacy rules that hospitals have to abide by, they can't really speak about someone's medical condition with right. anybody other than a spouse or a parent if you're a minor child. But even a parent becomes outside that circle when you're over 21, right?
That's correct.
So the primary person has to give specific, explicit permission for the doctors to speak with any other person about their condition.
Right.
And when you're unconscious, this is a little difficult to do.
Yes.
Right.
So, you need someone there to help you through your stay in the hospital.
Right. So it was fortunate that she had lined this up with you years before.
Right.
Right.
It was really catastrophic, and I never really thought I would have to do that for her.
Right.
So,
were you aware that she had, or was she aware that she had this condition, or this is
new? It was new for her. She was diagnosed with diabetes probably a few months before, and she wasn't aware of the symptoms.
Right.
She thought it was a virus, or she just was under the weather, and she thought that this would pass, and, you know, she tried to eat something. She just didn't feel good.
Mm-hmm.
And so she ate something, thinking that the taste would help it go down and her stomach would feel better. And that wasn't good. And she had blurry vision, and she didn't put it all together, thinking that it was the diabetes that was the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so she ended up in trouble.
Yeah. And she didn't feel aware enough of the crisis that it took call for
right.
help.
Right.
And so being in a coma for that length of time, she had a lot of getting well to do.
Yes. And she's on the road to recovery, but she still has a ways to go.
Hmm. So now, did you have decisions you needed to make, or were you primarily just...
Well, the only real decision I had to make was her taking blood from her all the time. She has very poor veins, and the poor woman really suffered when they took blood. So we asked that this not be done as quite as often, or maybe they could take it from the, I don't know what it's called, a HEPA or something?
Yeah, sometimes they install some sort of a catheter so that they don't have to stick you all the time.
Right.
They've got one line that dwells in.
Well, they tried that, and sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't work, and so that was the only... it was terrible to watch her just writhe in pain when they tried to take blood from her. And she tried to take out all of the tubing that she had, and she was really uncomfortable.
Yeah, and she wasn't conscious enough to realize that she was not doing herself a favor.
Right.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So you were able to be there and soothe and help make some decisions to make her more comfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a trying time for her, and I tried to help with whatever I could.
Sure.
We'll be back in a moment to speak a little bit more with Fran, and then later in the show we're going to meet Fantastic Frank. Stay tuned. Please go to powerfulpatient.org on the internet. You will find the program guides for this show with information about the people that we've spoken with, the websites that we've referenced, and some other background on the information that we've discussed. And as always, we would appreciate your support in making this show happen. Please donate to the Cancer Research Fund and bring us back another day. Thank you. Stay with us now, and we'll be right back. We're back speaking with Fran in Massachusetts about her experience as healthcare proxy for her friend Lisa.
Mm. So what have you learned about being a healthcare proxy, choosing to be one, and also maybe choosing to line one up for yourself, if you haven't already?
Well, I haven't done that. Well, actually, I did do that. I think my daughter is my healthcare proxy. I did that before I went on a trip recently.
Mm-hmm.
And being a healthcare proxy, you really have to make some somehow to make some decisions. I'm not sure what those decisions were really, but the responsibility going with it is to be there for the person and to be available and just to help with whatever.
Right, in this situation,
even coordination of people and family and who could come to visit and to get things for her, and when she came home, to organize people so that they didn't all pounce on her at the same time.
Right, so these weren't life and death decisions, but
no.
They certainly were the kinds of decisions that if she'd been conscious, she would have made herself. Right. Had you had a chance to talk with her at all before about how she felt about certain kinds of things so that you felt you were in tune with what she would have wanted to do? I mean, these weren't critical enough, I suppose, that it would have mattered, but had it been a life and death decision, it probably would have been a good idea to have had those conversations up front.
Yes, I didn't, though. I mean, mm-hmm. I figured it would never happen that I would have to do anything for Lisa because right. she was perfectly healthy to me.
Right.
But now I realize it's quite different. And I would strongly recommend that people do get a healthcare proxy because you need someone there in your corner to advocate for you.
Right. And then you mentioned when she came home, you helped to line things up. Because when she first came home, and she'd just been in the ICU for what, more than a week, and then they sent her home to, what, a third-floor walk-up or something?
I think it was a second floor. But, it was a walk-up, and not only was it a walk-up, but she had to get home by car and then walk from the parking lot to her steps to be able to get up into the condo. So that was difficult. And when she left the hospital, she had to use a cane and walk very slowly and carefully. And it was during the winter, so it was slippery outside.
So what were you able to organize to help her out at home?
Amongst her friends, I organized everybody to do something for her so she wouldn't have to think about anything. So one person picked her up from the hospital. Another person took her to get to the ophthalmologist when she needed the appointment with the ophthalmologist. Somebody else went grocery shopping for her. Someone did the laundry. There was food in the house so that she wouldn't have to worry about that. And she needed socks, white socks, because she had problems with her feet. So someone else went and purchased the socks for her. I mean, they're all little things, but the little things are really the important parts of her care. And so all of that worked. And then she had people coming in, physical therapists and the visiting nurse. And I made sure that the visiting nurse came. Originally they said that Lisa had canceled the visiting nurse. And I said, no. The visiting nurse is supposed to be there and to help her. So I made sure that those arrangements were all in place. And I was able to refer her to a podiatrist, that she needed a podiatrist, and I arranged for that. And then she needed to see an endocrinologist and to get hooked up with the Do It program at the Joslin. They have a 3-day program for people who are diabetic, and all sorts of resources at this program that the patient can take care of.
A special training program to learn how to manage your condition.
Right, and there's a nutritionist and an educator and all your needs in one place.
That's great.
So she's going to be attending that. I don't know what else.
But the kinds of things that you would have done for one would have done for oneself if she had been able to do that.
Right.
And because she couldn't walk up and down the stairs or drive herself to the grocery store, she needed her friends to do it. And your role then was as coordinator of all these volunteers, so to speak.
And the most important part was to coordinate the visits.
Tell me about that.
I don't know. I once was called a BD, Benevolent Dictator. And everybody wanted to see her. You know, everybody had to be in touch with Lisa because everybody loves Lisa. Lisa is a wonderful person. But it wasn't good for her being in ICU to have everybody there at the same time. So we made up a schedule, a little grid on the internet, and if somebody wanted to go and see her, we made sure that there were only two people at one time visiting, and that was really very, very helpful.
Good.
And I gave a daily update of news for Lisa. I had an email list called Lisa's Loves, and I would send it out to all of her friends and so on. To let them know, you know, we all wanted to be in touch with her, and so this was the way that everybody could be in touch with her.
That's great. Yeah, those communications are so very important.
Right.
Not only to her, but to all her friends to know that she's okay.
Well, to her friends, first of all, because she really wasn't with it for such a long while.
Right.
And then to her, because I think that she might have felt that nobody loved her anymore. You mm-hmm. know, I mean, it mm-hmm. must be very disconcerting to be in the ICU and nobody comes to visit.
Mm-hmm.
And so... so it was reassurance
this,
for her.
You have all those emails now, too,
yeah.
that she can read at her
right,
leisure.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, that's
so
great.
It all worked out in the end,
right.
you know, for her benefit.
Well, thank you.
Oh,
and
you're welcome.
Any other hints for people on what it would be wise to set up just in case? Because, as you say, this was a healthy woman, and it wasn't that she could foresee that there was necessarily a problem coming. But life tends to happen, you know. So it could have been an automobile accident or, you know, something else, too.
I think you should make sure to communicate with either a friend, a close friend, or a relative that you feel is responsible enough to help with your care and to be able to coordinate things in a timely way and mm-hmm. To help the hospital. You can't go...
Right.
Everybody can't go calling the hospital. They're there to take care of the patient, not to take care of the community.
Right.
And
right.
I think that's a very important part of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think it's important, too, to have that discussion about, you know, if, God forbid, you should be in a situation where there may be no quality of life ahead, what would your wishes be? Do you want all those machines and everything, or please don't do the machines?
Right.
Yeah, because, you know, it is possible that someone else is going to wind up having to make that decision for you. And that's not an easy thing to do if you have no information.
Well, I don't want to be able to just stay there and veg out if that should happen to me.
Yeah.
I want to be able to dance to the end of my days.
Or at least have some quality of life,
yeah.
even if dancing is not in the picture.
Well, I don't know. I think the dancing is an important part. And to be able to see a sunset and a sunrise,
yes.
I think, is very important.
For sure.
And especially after that beautiful eclipse last night. Wasn't that gorgeous? Did you see it?
I didn't see
it,
no.
It was just beautiful.
Well, Lisa's lucky to have had you to help with that.
Thank you.
It was nice for you
appreciate
to sign up to that.
Yeah, well, she's just a wonderful person.
Yeah.
Just wonderful. And what a rich circle of friends she has.
Mm.
She's great.
Great.
I'm lucky to have her in my life.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Well, thank you.
Stay with us now, and we'll be back right after this message with Fantastic Frank.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL. Is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
Hi, Joyce. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Just good? What would it take to change your state to be great or outstanding or brilliant or awesome or wonderful or supercalifragilisticexpialidocious?
Well, and how are you, Frank?
I'm fantastic.
Let me introduce Frank Johnson. Frank is otherwise known as Fantastic Frank, and the reason for that is what you just heard. He introduces himself always as being fantastic. And when you get to know this guy, you get a real appreciation for how every day each of us has a choice. When we get out of bed, we can choose to have a good day or a bad day or a fantastic day. And his choice is always for a fantastic day. This is a man who has been through both success and failure, both health and the opposite of health. 20 years ago, he says, I had already done many things in my life. I had been married, written songs, ran a fantasy mail order company for comic books. He had been in the army. He had earned an advanced degree from a prestigious university. He ran his own business, and he was working as a successful chemical engineer for one of the biggest companies in the United States. And then came the night of the fire.
People at my church laugh. They say, here comes Fantastic Frank, but they anchor my face in, so next time they see me, they have to be fantastic. But I try and coach them that they can't steal my word. It has to be either awesome or outstanding or brilliant. Or I particularly like it when women throw back their hair and say wonderful.
Oh, that's great. So you make people feel happy and feel beautiful. So Frank had quite a traumatic incident when he was 30 years old. Would you mind sharing some of that with us?
Well, I was an entrepreneur at heart. I used to be a chemical engineer at Eastman Coal Company. I ran something called a fantasy mail company, which it wasn't anything to have to do with what you might think it had to do. It was the first mail or comic book company in the country, which is how this will piece together with my purpose in life. God works in mysterious ways. But I had this entrepreneurial spirit all my life. And one of the things, while I was a chemical engineer at Eastman Coal Company,
You were with Eastman Kodak.
I was at Eastman Coal Company. I was a chemical engineer. I have a BS in chemical engineering from Clarkson College of Technology, which I got in 1971. But even though they paid me a good salary, I wasn't content with the money I'm making. So I ran these art couple businesses. One was a fantasy mail company, but I also bought a bar and a restaurant. And one night, I got trapped in a fire at this bar and restaurant. It was called Mugs Up. It was located down in Rochester, New York, across from the Eastman Theater.
It was called Mugs Up, a nice beer and pub.
Yes, it was a beer and hamburger joint.
And there was a fire.
Yes, I was trapped in this fire.
Oh, my goodness.
And I have what is now, I didn't discover this until 3 or 4 years ago, because God worked in my path again. And I have what is known as a traumatic brain injury, which can come from, I almost died from carbon dioxide poisoning. And what happened was, when you're overcome by carbon dioxide, it just first it destroys your fine motor skills.
Oh my.
The second thing it does, it cuts the oxygen off to your brain. Fortunately, I had very little of the second thing done. Otherwise, I'd be dead, say, I'd be worse off than I am. The reason I have a problem or a challenge talking is a fireman partially damaged my voice box when he inserted a trach tube. But there's more to the story.
Let me just clarify a little bit before we go on. So he was trapped in the fire.
Yes.
And then a fireman came to rescue you. And you were deprived of oxygen to a small extent. Yes. But the bigger problem is that there was too much carbon dioxide or carbon monoxide.
Well, I will really know what it was.
I don't know. But in any event, you had serious smoke problems.
Yes, I had smoke inhalation damage.
Yes. And then because of these chemical issues, there was damage to your brain. And this is known as traumatic brain injury.
Short for TBI, which I never even heard that term until 2 or 3 years ago.
Right.
And there's a story behind I have found that, but I want to go back to this story.
Sure, go ahead.
I was unconscious, I think, for around 5 or 6, it was either weeks or days, I can't remember how many days I was unconscious. I woke up, I said, what the heck happened? My wife, I was married at the time, she explained what the heck happened to me, and my entire life had changed. I so wanted to go back to Eastman Coil Company where I knew my job, but I didn't get the chance to go back till 6 months after this had happened because Eastman Coil Company, they didn't know what the heck to do with me.
Right.
I had to retake my driver's license. I had to run tests on my body.
Right.
And nothing was happening at Eastman Coil Company until finally Colbert Chandler used to be a CEO of Eastman Coil Company in 1980 when this happened.
Mm-hmm.
And Clarkson College, it's now called Clarkson University, has at least a 10% of the population at Eastman Coil Company had been hired by Clarkson people. They hired Clarkson people. Well, they had this meeting down there at building a world fire. I'll never forget this day. I walked up to Colby Chandler. I took him by my horns. It's something I'm not afraid to do. I said, Colby, my name's Frank Johnson. I'm trying to get rehired. And bam, the next day, I got a phone call from Michael Prevenge, who was he worked in the employment rehire. And she's like, oh, what the heck happened? But you got rehired. Come on back in here.
Oh, wonderful. Well, so let me just clarify for a second. So you had been working for Eastman Kodak for how many years?
I've been 10 years.
You were 10 years as a chemical engineer with Kodak. And when you had this injury, you were out of work, obviously, for about 6 months.
I was placed on disability.
Right. So you were out on long-term disability.
Actually, it turned out to be short-term Kodak disability.
Okay, right. And so you were out for about 6 months. And then you wanted to go back to your job, they were good enough to put you back in your job. Were you able to fully function in the job?
The thing is, my job, I used to be in charge of making photographic chemicals for a process called C4D1, which is a chemical process for developing chemicals.
Yeah, that's the developing process for color, right?
For color products. Which is a black and white, which is a color negative.
Okay.
And then they hired somebody to refill my job. And they put me someplace else where they tested my ability to function. I couldn't function the same as I could.
Sure.
They placed me on disability after I've been totally vested with Eastman Coil Company. I have 15 years.
Right.
I've been on disability since 1986.
Well, that's very nice that Kodak did that. I mean, now there's laws to protect people, but in those days there weren't laws.
Yes, that's right.
And you were really up to the grace of the company, so it's good that they handled that so well.
The fire changed Frank's life quite completely. He survived the fire. He survived divorce. Bankruptcy. He lost his business. He lost his singing voice. He lost his job as a chemical engineer. He lost fine motor control, and he also lost 50% of his lung capacity. He knew, for example, that his voice box had been damaged when they had administered a tracheotomy to restore his breathing, and he knew that that was impacting his ability to speak. What he didn't realize was that his brain had also been injured. And it wasn't until he met a woman who was herself in rehabilitation services that she recognized what was happening.
She said, Frank, do you realize you have what is known as a traumatic brain injury? I said, no, tell me what that's about. She said,
Right. Anytime
you get blood cut off your throat, this can happen to having a stroke, to having a car accident, from hitting your head. It can happen from birth. It happens in many different ways that I can qualify to have service come my house. Well, I now get free service even at my house.
He was unaware that he had a traumatic brain injury, or TBI, and that this qualified him for some special rehabilitative services for brain injury, but he's now hooked into that rehabilitation as well. So you met this woman who was from the Center for Disability Research?
Disability Rights.
The Center for Disability Rights in Rochester?
Yes.
Right, and she's the one who recognized that you had the traumatic brain injury is really a difficult thing for people to recognize. And a lot of people with this condition don't get the sympathy that they deserve, you know, because when you break your leg, you've got a cast on your leg. It's pretty obvious that you broke your leg. But when you have an injury to your brain, there's nothing really visible from the outside. Nobody realized that your brain got shook up to the point that it has an injury that's just as real as breaking your leg.
Well, my biggest challenge is when I speak to people either think I'm dumb or I'm retired or something else is wrong. When actually, I just had a damage that has occurred my voice box when a fireman entered the straight tube.
Right, so there was also this damage to your voice box. But so you have the two issues going on, the TBI as well as the damage to your voice box. But I think you do very well.
Thank you very much.
Handled it slowly. This late in the game, he is unlikely to make big progress, but he can make some small progress and adapt what he's able to do. In rehabilitation, you learn to focus on what you can do and not focus on what you can no longer do. Just work around it. Try to find new ways for your body to take over some of the functions that no longer work. And the same is true in life. So Frank has undertaken a new project. Since your disability retirement, you've undertaken a new project, right?
Yes, I have. And this project took around 15 more years for me even to develop.
We were looking earlier at the comic book that you've created, and I love your beautiful comic book. Tell us about the intent of this project.
Okay, well,
my comic book.
First of all, when I was a little boy, I collected comic books. That's where my fascination with comic books came from. I always watched Superman on TV when George Reeves, he was really a Superman.
That's right.
Suicide.
I remember George Reeves. I watched it faithfully.
But he committed, that almost broke my heart. I think it was 1956 or 57. I had seven or eight that almost destroyed my life when he committed suicide.
Yeah.
Faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound. Look, up in the sky. It's a bird. It's a plane. It's Superman.
From a very young age, he began to build his comic book collection.
But then God works in mysterious ways because I didn't go. I was smart enough to go to MIT. I wanted to go to MIT, but these people came up from Poughkeepsie, New York. They worked at Gold Key Comic Books. I started talking to them about my comic book collection, and that's why I went to Clarkson. Clarkson led me to Rochester. They led me to my fire. Everything comes for a reason.
Right.
But then I watch TV all the time. I see Tony Robbins on TV. He's on QVC selling a product, unleashed the power within. I got those tapes. One of my other problems is I can't, my fine motor skills, which I think I touched on.
Right.
But I can't even read my own handwriting.
Mm-hmm.
I took this book apart. I tore it apart. I started typing these answers in my book. Things started changing. I got a call from a woman who worked for Tony. She was one of his mentors. She was one of his people, salespeople. She said, Frank, do you want to come down for Unleash the Power in an event? I said, what the heck is that about? It's where I walk on burning hot coals. And I've done that five times. I only burnt myself the last time I went to that.
So let me back up for a sec. So you responded to this ad from Tony Robbins for his Unleash the Power Within, Tony Robbins program, which has a workbook.
Yes.
And because you couldn't handwrite, you tore the book apart and stuck it in the typewriter.
I stuck it in the typewriter. It started giving me focus on what I had to do.
I see.
It started saying things like, I could do my dreams, I could take care of my life.
Right.
I knew what to do. The power, all these powers are within me. These are mantras that Tony Robbins teaches you when you go there.
Right.
That I'm in control of my life, and that at this UPW, it was at the UPW, but the next event I attended was called Date with Destiny.
Now, hang on. Okay. So the UPW, what's the UPW?
That's Lisa Powell Inn.
Oh, okay. So you went...
a tape program called Lisa Powell Inn. Then she has a three-day weekend called Unleash a Power, a UPW event.
I see.
A three-day event with him where you walk on fire, do things like that.
Literally walk on fire?
Yes, yes.
Oh, my goodness. So you went to this three-day event with Tony Robbins, the Unleash the Power Within, where you walked on coals?
Yes, walked on burning hot coals. My feet never got burned.
Oh, no. So this is to teach you sort of mind over matter kinds of skills.
How you can do anything if you set your mind to it.
Goodness gracious. Yeah, well, but this was an important step for you because of having gone from being a chemical engineer to being on disability and now to realize there's still plenty left to do in your life and you have the power within you to do it.
Yes, and actually I was very afraid because of fire. I dislike being around people who smoke. I never smoked at all. My parents both smoked, but I have never smoked, and I hate being around people who smoke. So just the fact of I now had to overcome my fear of this fire. It was doubly because I knew what happened to me. That's how I got trapped on
fire. That's right, because of the fire problem. Yes. It was must have been terribly traumatic psychologically
as
well.
It was.
Yeah.
Well, at this event, I hear him talk about a guy had attended a similar event named Jim Hart or Jeff Hart, came back home, wrote the screenplay for Sleep Puss in Seattle, sold it for $250,000. I said, how hard could that be? Be completely naive about how hard that really could be.
Right.
Because then after I got involved in doing this, I did a research of Jeff Hart, whatever his name is. I found out he had been in the movie picture industry for the past 20 or 30 years. He's written things for Mission Impossible TV series. He's got other movie credits up the wazoo. The thing was, he had to go to Sony Pictures, whom he had direct contact with, and sell him his idea. I didn't realize that Tony just said he had the idea at the thing. I thought he came up with this idea, which he and I didn't realize he was that well connected.
Right, he wasn't just some unknown who came up with this brilliant idea.
No.
He had a very rich career already as a writer.
Yeah, then I had
so
this
you had
idea.
An idea for a comic book.
No, this was for a screenplay.
Ah, so you had an idea for a screenplay.
I commissioned three scripts to be written. Actually, I work with my compeer friend. My compeer friend, it's an organization who treats people who have mental and emotional disabilities. I'm a mentor for this
Comcare.
Guy. Compeer.
Compeer.
compeer.org is our website.
Okay. And this is an organization that works with people who have...
emotional and mental and physical disabilities.
Okay.
I'm a mentor for a guy who's got... I don't know what the heck he's got, but he's been my computer friend for almost, I've been there 30 years. He's been my friend for almost 25 of those years.
Nice.
I found me a professional writer who has written me what turns into three scripts.
His dream is to make this into a series of motion pictures like Star Wars or Harry Potter. And he's put that vision out into the universe to hopefully make it real. But in the meantime, he found a friend named Stan who convinced him that he should start with a comic book.
Stan said comic books are often made to movies every day. Spider-Man, Superman, Batman, X-Men, Fantastic Four. They took 30, 40 years. However, there's been comic books like Men in Black. That was a comic. That was often.
Oh, that's right. I forgot.
There was also The Legally Trained Gentleman. That was a comic book. That was often after 2 years. There's been some other ones, too. There was another one. American Splendor. Have you ever heard of that movie?
No.
That was a comic book.
Tell me the object of the story that you were creating.
The object of the story had evolved as I've grown. You take five kids, you put them in danger, and every kid has within a hidden talent. You know, what happens so I get put to a test?
So you don't know what you're capable of until you're put to the test.
Every kid, every purpose, unless you have been tested, unless you have a test put in your life, you never know what the heck's going to happen.
I heard a saying the other day that women are like tea bags. You put them in hot water and they get stronger.
Yeah, that's it.
Stay with us, please, and we'll be back right after these messages to talk some more with Fantastic Frank about his comic book series and the good messages for children that he wants to impart. Please go to powerfulpatient.org on the internet. You will find the program guides for this show with information about the people that we've spoken with, the websites that we've referenced, and some other background on the information that we've discussed. And as always, we would appreciate your support in making this show happen. Please donate to the Cancer Research Fund and bring us back another day. Thank you. Stay with us now, and we'll be right back. We're back now talking with Frank Johnson, otherwise known as Fantastic Frank, about his new comic book series. So you have these five children who are the protagonists of your comic book stories. And these three scripts are sequential or something? They're three stories about these same five protagonists.
And what happened is my partner Stan Rogers, he found a comic book artist out in the Philippines named Randy Monsey to draw my first issue. But unlike Star Wars started off with episode 3, because if they start episode 1, it wouldn't have gone any point.
Okay.
So my comic book doesn't start off with the origin, what the heck happened, to why these kids got mixed up in this.
The first comic book is called The Crypt, and as he says, it starts partway through the story, just as Star Wars does. And here we're going to hear the backstory. It seems that Commodore Horatio Sinbad wants to marry his one true love, Princess Latima. But Princess Latima has an evil twin sister, Princess Prunella.
They're at a masquerade ball, and Princess Latima gets distracted by one of these kids. And she puts her mask down to go to help out what takes going on. And her evil twin sister picks up her mask. The comrade, he proposes to his evil one by mistake.
There are only a few people who know about the problem here. The king knows, the queen knows, but they're trying to keep it to a restricted number of people. But Princess Prunella is trying very hard to make trouble for her sister. She's not going to let him get out of this promise to her very easily at all. If he breaks his promise, then he either has to be beheaded or banished from the country, neither of which alternatives appeal to him very highly.
Every time you're faced with two choices, realize that aren't there always a third choice. You have to find out what the third choice is.
In an effort to discover what third choice might be available to him, he studies the history of the country and discovers that there was a similar event that occurred about 500 years before. If he can achieve knighthood, then he can break his promise and still retain his honor and not need to be beheaded or banished. In order to achieve knighthood, he has to do 7 Herculean tasks. And the first of those is to find a diary which is interred in a cemetery. And that's where they go to the crypt to find this diary. And the diary will contain the 6 additional tasks that need to be performed. He's allowed to take with him 5 helpers, and since Princess Prunella is the one who's being scorned, she gets to choose the 5 people who are going to help him out.
And she picks these 5 kids who she runs a Blue Hills orphanage to go on his mission, not realizing that she picks the exact 5 kids who have the hidden talents. They're going to be tested Every kid has a hidden talent. God places people in their path for a reason. They are five people who are in the right place at the right time.
So this gentleman, the knight, who wants to marry the good princess, is supposed to be able to have five people to help him, but Princess Prunella gets to choose who these are going to be, and she chooses these five orphan kids, thinking they're she's sending along no help at all.
Yes, when she's helping him out with doing the very thing he has to do.
So tell us about these five orphan kids. First, there's Lily, who's a 12-year-old girl who's also a bit of a gymnast. Then there's Ono, who's an 8-year-old boy who speaks with strange words, like a foreign language.
In the original comic book, we took it as it's a foreign language that nobody knows.
Okay.
But it's going to develop into like a speech impediment. That's because I have a bit of a speech impediment.
Sure. So Ono, who has a little bit of autobiographical characteristic to him. Then there's Jack, who's the oldest boy, and Wise Guy, who's a bit of a know-it-all, but doesn't really know it all. And then Gizmo. Gizmo's the geek, and he knows how to deal with just about any piece of machinery.
And every kid has these hidden talents. You never know what the heck is going to happen until you get put to a test. So Lily has to go, and she has to recover this diary from this crypt. That's why my first comic is called The Crypt.
Okay.
And she has to go through this. There are rats, there's a lot of problems. And she has to go and get this because she's a gymnast and she knows how to get through these traps. And she gets through and she gets these.
Lily has some gymnastic talents as well.
Yeah, she has gymnastic talents.
And they go through these various mazes, essentially, like the old computer games, going through the mazes and conquering the different problems along the path.
They do.
And they find the diary, and the prince marries the princess and lives happily ever after.
This is the end of my first book. She gets the diary. Now from there, they have to go and do the other six tests.
Right, but you don't want to tell the whole story on the show. So let's talk more about the goals of the enterprise. You talked about helping children realize their hidden talents.
Yes, because going wrong with hidden talents, it's the concept of water flows down the path of least resistance. If I had only followed my dream of my passion was comic books. When I was a young kid, I wouldn't have taken this circuitous path to becoming a comic book producer when I'm 58. I had my 158th comic book produced when I'm 58, not my first.
Yes.
So that's something else that has to be written into the story, too.
Right. So your passion for comic books as a child has turned into a profession or an avocation, certainly.
And everybody has these hidden talents. If you ask anybody why they are doing what they do today, you can usually find out an event that happened in their childhood that cemented this idea, this dream, this desire. It might have been unfulfilled. They might have taken paths that made no sense to them, but you can always find it in anybody. I've asked this question to hundreds of people. Everybody tells me that they had some childhood dream that went unfulfilled, or they are now fulfilling it 20 or 30 or 40 years later, or they wish they had discovered later on.
Which ones did you like the best?
When I was a little boy, I loved Superman.
The Superman.
That was my first comic book. I think I bought, I got a cold.
Uh-huh.
My father had taken me to the newsstand to buy some cold drops. While I was there, I saw my first comic book. I think it was an action-adventure comic book. It had to be issue number 200. Because this had to be 1956. It had to be on 200. I bought that. That's how I got love with include comic books.
Right. They were a wonderful escape for us kids. And I also enjoyed, in the Disney ones, the a couple, like Goofy, always spoke in a slang.
He did like that, didn't he?
Yes, well, and you had to really puzzle out what he was saying because it wasn't properly spelt and things. So there were a lot of neat challenges about comic books that I think in some ways kids have lost these days. They watch it on TV, which isn't the same thing. They don't get the same sort of reading verbal skills benefit out of it that we did with comic books. So now you've had this comic book illustrated by someone in Asia, and it's been put together. Yeah, this is a beautiful issue.
He's in the Philippines.
In the Philippines. And it's beautiful, the comic
Thank
book
you
that
very
you've
much.
Produced. And how is the comic book available?
Anybody wants it, they could go to my website,
www.fantasticfrank.com.
I think you can place an order for it there.
If someone would like to see the first 5 or 6 pages of the comic book, you can see it on the website youngexplorersadventures.com. And we'll have that in the resource guide for the show as well.
So the goal of this is not only to realize your childhood dream of writing your own comic book, but also to help children.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
And have you worked with other collaborators on this, or have you tested it on kids?
Okay, well, we went to Chicago last year where we met Fat Mama. Anybody who knows anything about Stan Lee's Who Wants to Be a Superhero, she was at our booth. Fat Mama was the second runner-up, and we impressed her. On the way up there, I met a woman named Peggy, who is at the Pratt Institute down in New Jersey, where she sponsors something called America's Reads. Next month, this is February, end of March, I'm going down there where they're going to have kids. They do the American Readout. There's going to be a readout rundown, where they're going to be performing this play based on my comic book. There's going to be 800 kids there.
That's terrific, and that's one step closer to your film. So this is very much Frank's story. You take very bad odds with life throwing everything but the kitchen sink at you, and yet you believe in yourself, and you utilize the gifts you do have, and you can overcome anything. That's the kind of message we all need to hear. Thank you, Frank.
Is there anything else you want to say about your project that you want to leave with people?
If anybody wants to help me get this idea out that kids have hidden concepts, hidden talents, anybody who wants to contact me, please do.
Well, and I think that you're a perfect example of anybody can create something if they want to, and you've overcome a lot of challenges in order to get as far as you've gotten. Even before you sell your first millionth comic books, I think you've overcome a lot of challenges.
Thank you very much, Joyce.
Yeah, I know you're living with a lot of difficulties, but I think you're doing it great.
I usually sign my email address, Fantastic Frank, who lives every day with Can Eyes and Passion. Can Eyes, that's in a constant and never-ending improvement. And Passion.
Great.
Which I do.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Joyce.
Thank you very much for being with us today and sharing in the joy of these two interviews. I hope that you found some useful things in them for yourself. I know that I did. I enjoyed very much meeting with these good people. And don't forget Frank's advice, declare your state when someone asks you how you are.
Hi, Frank. How are you?
Fantastic.
Next week, we're going to talk with Adrian Ashley, who has a very interesting new book called Every Single Girl's Guide to Her Future Husband's Last Divorce. And she's an expert on dating and relationships, and she's just going to give us some of her own insights into dating for people with handicaps or medical conditions. She herself does have both a handicap and an ongoing medical condition that she was concerned about, and it took her a while to work up her nerve to share it with her husband. So I think you'll find it very interesting interview, and I hope that you'll join us next week. Thanks so much for being with us. Be well and be a powerful patient.